From WIPR in Baltimore, I'm Tom Hall, and this is Choral Arts Classics. Tonight, we begin our 12th season of Choral Arts Classics with a conversation about Johann Sebastian Bach and one of his great settings of the biblical verse known as the Magnificat. For the past few weeks, the Choral Arts Society has been busy preparing for a performance of this great masterpiece next month on Saturday afternoon, October 25th at Goucher College's Krausauer Auditorium. Our full chorus and orchestra will give our first performance of Bach's Magnificat in nearly 30 years. In a few minutes, I'll be joined by Ray Sprenkel, the composer and musicologist who is a great friend of this show and a well-known lecturer on all things musical. We'll talk about Bach and what makes his Magnificat so magnificent. Hello again, and thanks for joining us for Choral Arts Classics. I'm Tom Hall, the music director of the Baltimore Choral Arts Society and the culture editor for Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast here on 88.1. WIPR. Glad you could be with us tonight. And as we have done for the past 11 years, on the last Tuesday night of the month from September through April, we'll get together and we'll listen and talk about great choral and vocal music. We'll sample some recordings and live performances of the Baltimore Choral Arts Society and our special guests. I appreciate your tuning in and joining us. So as I mentioned, we're going to talk tonight about one of Bach's singular gems, his Magnificat. We'll listen to a recording of the last time we had the great pleasure of performing it, way back in 1985. We'll start with the first couple of movements of Bach's setting of this Christmas text. The words come from the first chapter of Luke in the Christian New Testament. Mary, who will soon become the mother of Jesus, is visiting her cousin, Elizabeth, who, despite her advanced age, is pregnant with a son who will be born 3 months later. The son, by the way, grows up to be John the Baptist, an important figure later in the New Testament when Jesus begins his ministry. So in the verse before the Magnificat text, Elizabeth proclaims Mary to be blessed among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb. So these lines are later incorporated into the Ave Maria, or the Hail Mary prayer, which Catholics recite while saying the Rosary. It's the next passage from the Gospel of Luke that comprises the Magnificat. Mary answers Elizabeth by saying, "My soul doth magnify the Lord, and my spirit hath rejoiced in God my Savior." So here's Sebastian Bach's musical setting of those two lines. The first part is set for chorus, and the second part is set for a solo soprano. I conducted the Choral Arts Full Chorus and Orchestra in November 1985, the first movement of Bach's Magnificat, our first offering tonight on Choral Arts Classics. Thank you. On 88.1 WIPR, it's Choral Arts Classics. I'm Tom Hall. This is music by J.S. Bach, the opening two movements of his setting of the Magnificat. I conducted the Baltimore Choral Arts Society Full Chorus and Orchestra in a performance we gave in November of 1985. We heard the first movement, Magnificat Anima Mea Dominum, for chorus and orchestra, followed by the soprano aria, Et Exultavit, sung in this live performance by Marvis Martin. Again, the words mean, "My soul doth magnify the Lord, and my spirit hath rejoiced in God my Savior." It's my pleasure now to welcome back to the program one of my saviors, Ray Sprenkel. He recently retired from the faculty of the Peabody Conservatory of Music, and if you're a music lover, chances are very good that you've heard him present lectures about music for organizations like the Shriver Hall Concert Series and many others. Back in the day, he even hosted a music program on WIPR's predecessor, WJHU, Radio. Ray Sprenkel, always good to see you. Good evening.
I was going to say, back in the day, Tom, this is 1985.
Yeah.
That was 300th anniversary.
Yes.
Was the whole concert devoted to Bach?
We did Bach and Handel.
Bach and Handel.
Both of them, because Handel and Bach both born in 1685.
Right.
So we were part of the worldwide celebration of Bach and Handel. Two very different musical personalities.
My goodness. Yeah, night and day. But food for thought. We did it at Second Church, and I was holding forth there at the time.
And Magnificat.
Yeah, and Margaret Budd, the wonderful organist there, one of the best Bach players I've ever heard, she arranged an all-day affair for Bach's birthday. And I remember, I don't know if you're allowed to say this on the air here or not, but I remember Denise Koch,
WJZ television,
was not a prime anchor at the time, but she was doing features, and she did a feature on the program, and that's how far we go back.
Yeah, we do indeed. Yeah, we were on that program, the Choral Arts Society.
That's right.
We did a whole thing.
You remember?
Yeah. Had a great time. Bach is one of those presences in music that this overwhelming personality.
Certainly in our lifetime, you think it's almost been a crescendo since then. Each year it seems more and more Bach. Can't get enough Bach. I wonder if there'll be a reaction.
You think they go the other way?
Yeah, I think it'll go towards Handel.
Yeah. So as you explain to folks the difference between these two musical personalities, both giants, Both historically revered, both successful in their own ways during their lifetimes.
And iconic figures now.
Yeah. What's different?
Well, the simple thing is to say that Handel was the more vocal of the two and Bach was the more instrumental. But if you take a piece by the Magnificat, it's so singable. And you make these statements, then you find music by the other party that seems to contradict what you just said. But I think in general, that's the first thing that comes to my mind.
Mm-hmm. Of course, Handel working in a much larger place, working in London in the last part of his life, born in Germany, a little time in Italy, then goes to England and, hooks up fairly quickly with, no less a personage than the King of England.
I know. Yeah. So those doors seem to have opened for Handel very quickly.
They really did. And so he's on this large world stage.
Ticket-buying public is what he worked for.
Yeah. Very different than the audiences that Bach was working for.
And Bach's audiences probably could have cared less, frankly. I don't know. There's some videos that have come out recently, one by John Elliott Gardner, who argues—
Bach scholar and conductor. He's just written a very interesting book about Bach.
Yeah. Yes. He argues that during the church service in Leipzig, it was just a fashion show, and the High Society of Leipzig would parade through the church talking, and back in the corner was old man Bach making his music.
Yeah, but people are chatting away through it. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's interesting that Bach held, five or six positions throughout his life. This piece, the Magnificat, was written during his first Christmas at his final stop.
Yeah, I've always wondered about the Magnificat. Was this the first piece that church would have heard of his, which was written on a fairly large scale?
Yeah.
It's a thought that went through my mind.
Yeah, absolutely. Because this is for Christmas Day of 1724, right as he
23.
Came. Or 23, yeah. Rather. Yeah. Right as he just came to Leipzig.
Just come.
So Leipzig is this town that hires him. He ends up staying there 25 years till the end of his life.
He dies there.
He comes there because he wanted to raise his children.
Yeah, he's got a lot of kids. He's got to put food on the table.
Right. And he wants to raise them in a Lutheran environment.
That's correct.
Because he had held some positions that were, court positions, but this one wasn't. This was a church job.
This was a church job, and he had just come from Köthen, which was a court position. And according to his own letters, he was about as happy as he ever was there. So he never said that about Leipzig, never, to my knowledge. As a matter of fact, a lot of the testimony we have from Leipzig as the years go on is that Bach ran into personalities that he didn't get along with, and he felt like his worth was diminished, and he wasn't getting any respect, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Not an uncommon complaint by a lot of church musicians to this day.
Yeah, to this day.
And, of
yeah.
course, Bach, we also have some documents that show that Bach wasn't even the first choice for the job.
I think it was Telemann.
Yeah.
That's right. Listen, if you go to St. Thomas's, there's a statue outside the church, and it's a statue of Bach, and he's
this
there.
This is the Thomaskirche in,
right,
Leipzig,
in Leipzig,
which was Bach's church.
This was his principal church, and there's a statue of him outside the church, and he's got a pocket pulled out. This symbolism meaning, I'm not getting paid enough.
Yeah.
And if you read the few the letters that we have, he's always complaining about, he's just not getting paid.
Yeah. He's always petitioning for more firewood.
Yeah, it's very mundane.
The apartment is cold. And his influence in the world considerably less than Handel's his life, because again, Handel's on this world stage. Bach is on this virtually a small parish church. I mean, Leipzig wasn't a dinky town, but it was by no means the kind of metropolis.
London. It was not London. Rome, and it wasn't London. But Tom, I think it was a publishing center and a university town. I read one account that in Bach's world, that world of Orthodox Lutheran thought, it was the equivalent of San Marco. But you read a sentence like that for Catholicism in Venice. Mm-hmm. And you read a sentence like that and you say, my goodness, was it really? Well, Lutheranism was a very small thing in those times, as big as it is today, or since the Reformation or Reformation. It was very small compared to the Catholic world.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So Leipzig was small.
And interesting that Bach, as a Lutheran, a devout Lutheran, very well read in Lutheran biblical commentary.
We know his library, at least when he died, the books that he had, because they were part of the estate. And we know the titles. And he had something like almost 100 volumes on religious commentary.
Sure.
Which was a sizable library. The other books he had, Tom, which you know, I'm sure, are, a lot of them are on mathematics.
Right.
For whatever it's worth, those stories are true.
Right. And his encyclopedic approach to a lot of things sort of, back up that predilection that he had for that kind of calculation and figuring things out. You know, he writes, pieces in which he writes something in every single key, goes through what we call in music the circle of fifths.
There's one piece in the Magnificat that comes to mind, which we can talk about.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, we're gonna be hearing that, I think, if I'm guessing right about the one you're thinking, is it the chorus?
Yes, it is, right.
So we're going to dive back into this performance that the Choral Arts Society gave back in 1985. We're going to listen to a chorus called Vom Himmel Hoch, which is in German. This is an interpolation of music that was written by his predecessor, actually, a guy named Johann Kuhnau, which he sort of reconfigured and then stuck in at various places to the Magnificat text. The Magnificat text, of course, in Latin. Interesting, we're saying about his deep Lutheranism. Here's a guy who's written two of the most well-known popular settings of Catholic
liturgy
text, the B minor Mass, and this Magnificat, which is really a Catholic text, not a Lutheran text.
Food for thought. Well, I don't know what it means, but food for thought.
So we're going to listen to Vom Himmel Hoch, and that's followed by an aria called Quia Respexit Humilitatem. It's an aria for soprano. And then this chorus, Omnes Generationes. So why does the thought of mathematics come up when you hear about Omnes Generationes?
For me, let me see, Bach... you take the letter B, and that's the second letter in the alphabet, and then the letter A, and then the letter C and H. If you add up the numbers for Bach, B-A-C-H, you get 14. And in the chorus, Omnes Generationes, there are 41 entries of the musicians use the term subject, 41, which of course is 14 mirrored. Another scholar has pointed out that here, The text is from the Gospel of Luke, but here Bach refers to the 41 generations from the beginning of time to the birth of Jesus that are alluded to in the Gospel of St. Matthew. Those are the two things I think of.
Yeah.
For anybody listening and they say, that can't possibly be the case, that it happens so often in Bach's music, these numerological overtones, that it's not serendipity. There's calculation here.
Yeah, it's tough to believe that it's all just coincidence. All right, so here we have some more music from Bach, from Himmelhoch, the aria Quia Respexit, and then the chorus Omnes Generationi, music of Bach here on Choral Arts Classics.
Thank you.
Music of J.S. Bach in a live performance by the Full Chorus and Orchestra of the Baltimore Choral Arts Society. We heard the chorus Vom Himmel hoch, followed by the aria Quia respexit, sung by the soprano Barbara Martin, and then that beautiful rambunctious chorus Omnes Generationes. This is music from the Magnificat by Bach, which we're previewing tonight on Choral Arts Classics in advance of the Choral Arts Society's performance of this great masterpiece October 25th at Krausar Auditorium. On 88.1 WIPR, I'm Tom Hall, joined in the studio tonight by my good friend Ray Sprenkel. This is such incredible music.
It is, and it's one of these pieces by Bach that has more history to it than you might first imagine. We were talking before, Tom, that the work is put together in 1723, and it's actually written in E-flat, and he takes the Latin Magnificat and adds to it those four interpolated pieces in German in this strange key of E-flat. We were just talking before the... During the music, that wonder what those trumpets sounded like.
It's hard for the trumpets the clarinos, in those days to play in the key of E flat. It's much easier for them to play in the D major. Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's what happened because some years later, the date I've run across is 1730. He makes an arrangement. He lowers the whole thing a half step to D major, which is the key that we all use today and we've all grown up with. And the trumpets suddenly make all the sense in the world, and he leaves the German interpolations out, and then there's speculation as to why he did this. Alfred Durr, D-U-R-R, a great Bach scholar, suggests that Bach may have added mine a Vespers performance for Easter Day, and that makes good sense to me, frankly, when I think about it. Or Pentecost. I've read other things about the Feast of the Visitation, which is in the middle of July. That doesn't make any sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate, Tom and I have sort of grown up with the D major version.
Of course, this text comes from that visitation text.
It does.
We were talking about earlier. Yeah.
I would think that the Trumpet Guild was so powerful in Bach's day. Aren't they all on vacation in the summer? I mean, yeah. I don't know.
Well, it shows that, you know, Bach, Handel, Vivaldi, all these folks writing at this time were very flexible. I mean, they were not writing music that they thought to be ossified and absolutely, you know, the final
word. No, this
was
not published.
Yeah.
This is all handwritten music.
You know, and so if he had an occasion to do it in E-flat major in the beginning, he had, for whatever reason, some inspiration to do it in that very strange key. Then he says, nope, it's not going to work so well at that. We're going to switch it down to D major, in which it works, you know, magnificently. But, of course, he's writing for occasions. He is always writing for particular events. In this case, a church service on Christmas Day. The congregation has already sat through a four-hour church service during the day. And then that evening, there's a Vespers service, which is the evening prayer. And he writes this piece for that occasion. Just like every Sunday, he wrote cantatas for each day of that, you know, each Sunday of the liturgical year.
Dora, I mentioned him before, D-U-R-R, principal editor of the... the Neue Bach-Ausgabe, which is the second complete works edition of complete works of Bach, which was finished 6 or 7 years ago.
Yeah, they've been at it for a long time.
50 years, basically our lifetimes. And he has some interesting things to say. One of them is that Bach liked to use the word concerto instead of cantata, which is, you don't hear that every day.
A concerto is a form that you often associate with instrumental music, a concerto for piano and orchestra or violin and orchestra. You don't associate that term with vocal music.
You don't. Cantata means comes from cantare, which means to sing. And the Magnificat, I guess you could say, is a kind of overblown cantata, a big cantata, twice as long as the typical cantata. Dora, the reason why it came to mind, Tom, is that in Bach's obituary, there's reference to Bach writing more than just this Magnificat, that he wrote 4 or 5 or maybe 10, and we just don't have them. The glory of this work, I think the reason why so many people like it is that it's to the point. You were talking about Christmas Day. They must have been in church a long time.
Yeah.
The movements are brief, and the piano vocal score, which I'm holding here in my hand, Bach did not have such a thing. I mean, the typical aria is about 2 pages long. And each movement, as you go through it, has a different instrument which is highlighted, and the parade of instruments here from beginning to end, it's almost a study in orchestration. So each aria has its own distinct color, and the play of the music and the words that he's setting, I think, have haunted students of Bach ever since.
Yeah, and he's very brief. The piece in general is very brief, and even each movement is very brief. We're going to listen to a duet called Et Misericordia, and then that's going to be followed by a chorus called Fecit Potentiam. And Fecit Potentiam, the entire text of this movement is Fecit Potentiam in braccio suo dispersit superbos mente cordi sui. So it's that one line from the Bible, from the first chapter of Luke. It means he hath showed might in his arm, and he has scattered the proud in the conceit of their heart. So he takes that one little nugget of an idea about the proud being scattered with their conceit, and he sets it in a just an amazing way. And by the way, a very difficult way to perform. It's difficult for the chorus to sing.
I can imagine, especially at quick tempo, and I imagine you're charging down the road, and then suddenly the music just collapses. Dispersit, he's scattered the proud superbos. Harmonically, it just grips you, which is to say Bach uses a superbos. There's a fermata at that point. And the dispersit, you can hear it ricochet through the choir. Suddenly, it's just one voice at a time, rapid fire. All of this by way of Bach trying to dramatically highlight the words to make the music reflect the text as it's going by. In this instance, I think you can really hear it if you're set up for it. I'm sure everybody who sings it is easily aware of it. But Tom, it's always struck me as fascinating that somebody could make this kind of gesture almost 300 years ago, and it still works for us in 2014.
Yeah, it's cinematic in its vividness.
Cinematic, great word.
It's wonderful, so clear. You understand absolutely every inkling and every nuance of the literary meaning of the words.
And this is a striking example, but you could take any movement of the Magnificat and go to the words, and you can see this this word painting or text painting, as it's sometimes called.
Yeah, and every movement is in a completely different style. Bach incorporates, like he did in the B minor Mass, he incorporates styles of the old school, Palestrina, the Renaissance composer,
true,
as well as this new stuff. So this first duet that we're going to hear, Et Misericordia, for alto and tenor, very lush, very beautiful, Italian, very pretty. And
Misericordia.
Misericordia. He has shown mercy. And then Fecit Potentiam, a very boisterous, rambunctious, another rambunctious chorus. So here's music of Bach featuring the full chorus and orchestra of the Baltimore Choral Arts Society from the Bach Magnificat here on Choral Arts Classics.
Misericordia, abrogeri ei
on 88.1 WIPR. It's Choral Arts Classics. This is music by J.S. Bach from his joyous and brilliant setting of the Song of Mary, or the Magnificat. We heard the duet Et Misericordia, sung by the alto Martha Jane Howe and tenor Frederick Ury, and the buoyant chorus Fecit Potentiam. I'm Tom Hall. I conducted the chorus and orchestra of the Baltimore Choral Arts Society in this performance that we gave back in 1985, and we're sampling some of that concert tonight as we get ready to perform the Magnificat again next month, October 25th at Goucher College's Krausar Auditorium. I'm joined in the studio this evening by the composer and musicologist Ray Sprankle. So it's brilliant music. It's passionate music. It's beautiful music. Sometimes it's purposely ugly music, this disperzit we were talking about before we listened.
Yes.
You could hear the proud being literally scattered away throughout the score until it all comes back with mente cordis suis, the conceit of their heart. The Renaissance composers talked about this technique as a matter of word painting, like literally showing the visual oral effect of the literary meaning through the music.
Well, we were talking about Handel before and the comparison between Bach and Handel, and I think for many people in America, England and America, Handel wrote so much music in English, and you go to Messiah, his most well-known work, surely, and the word painting there is self-evident. The crook ahead straight, every valley shall be exalted, that sort of thing. Well, and we don't hear it in Bach, but that's because we don't think in German and Latin.
Yeah.
If we could think in German and Latin, we would recognize that that's going on in Bach all the time. And I think the whole Baroque era is intoxicated with this business of making the music reflect the words. I think it was part of their sense of music being drama, the dramatic expression of words.
And of course, there were many, many other composers working simultaneously with Bach and Handel. And
yeah, I should have said dramatic Vivaldi. Portrayal of words.
Yeah. But the number of people making their livings as professional musicians,
this is the way
at
it was
this
done.
Time is enormous. So why do you think it is that those three in this era, what we call the Baroque era, which runs roughly from the middle of the 1600s through the end of the 1700s, why is it that these three, Bach, Handel, and Vivaldi, seem to rise above the crowd in such an overwhelming way? What sets them apart
from their fellow composers?
Yeah,
they're just better. What do you got to say?
Yeah, and better matters, doesn't it? Yeah,
yeah. And we know so much more about Bach now, Tom, as we were talking about earlier in a program, than we did 30 years ago, 40 years ago, and Handel. And actually, we're learning more about Vivaldi as I speak. There's a lot of stuff coming out of Vivaldi about him in the last 4 or 5 years. He was a major opera composer.
Sure.
And when I was a kid, that aspect of Vivaldi was completely unknown. He was the guy who wrote the same concerto 500 times, as the joke would go. Well, he didn't. And he didn't write the same opera 300 times. But it's another branch of Vivaldi, another part of him that has gotten forgotten as time has gone on. And we're digging it back up. And Vivaldi was just as sensitive to the words as Handel and Bach were.
Yeah. So as we continue and finish up listening to these last few sections of this Magnificat setting by Bach, and of course, as you mentioned, many other composers set this text, this Magnificat text, Mary's response to Elizabeth during the Visitation. But those are not pieces that we do. Those are not pieces that are in the repertoire. Those are not
That's
things
true.
That we think of quite often. Bach's is the one that really stands above the rest. We're going to hear one of these little Christmas interpolations that we talked about, a setting of music that his predecessor had written, and Bach has gussied up in any number of ways. This is Gloria in Excelsis Deo, and then a tenor aria, De Posuit. This is the Latin text, De Posuit Potentes, De Sedet et Exultavit Humilius, right? So he's put down the mighty from their seat, and he has exalted Humilius, the humble. What does he do in terms of
word-painting
here?
When he exalts, the shape of the line is always up, exultavit. And when he's putting down the mighty, De Posuit, the shape of the line is aggressively downward.
Yeah.
And again, if you heard this in English and you were thinking along these lines, you would think this immediately. We hear it in Latin, and most of us don't think about this at all when it's happening. It just gives us pleasure.
Sure. We're going to hear the last few choruses as well. One is written in the style of a Palestrina motet, Sicut locutus est et ad pastres. Patres nostros, as he spoke to our fathers, to
as
Abraham.
He spoke to our fathers, so his fathers, you use the old style of fugue.
Right.
The old style, fathers.
So he goes back to his musical fathers in the Renaissance.
Right,
so it's a piece
precisely.
That really could be easily mistaken for a Palestrina motet.
That's right. Half note pulse, kind of square, to be honest.
Yeah, this amazing encyclopedic knowledge of all the music that had come prior to him, as well as his ability to sum up what was going on.
And then it gives way to Baroque music, contemporary Baroque music, as the piece goes on.
This concerted style, we bring back the music of the Magnificat.
Oh, and speaking of that, it comes back with the doxology as it was in the beginning is now. So he takes the music from the beginning and brings it back at the end.
Because that's the words from the Gloria Patri, glory be to the Father, the Son, and Holy Spirit. Again, as it was in the beginning. We'll get to that in a second. But first, I want to thank you for your time this evening. Always a pleasure to see you. Thanks so much, and look forward to the next time.
Okay.
Ray Sprenkel, from formerly of the Peabody Conservatory. He retired just this year. We appreciate Ray's coming by tonight. So now we're back to the Magnificat of Bach. Here's the Gloria in Excelsis Deo, one of those Christmas interpolations we talked about, as well as the tenor aria De Posuit. Music of Bach on Choral Arts Classics. By J.S. Bach from the Magnificat. That was his setting of Gloria in Excelsis Deo for chorus and orchestra, followed by the virtuoso tenor aria Deposuit. Our tenor soloist was Frederick Urey. I'm Tom Hall. I conducted the full chorus and orchestra of the Baltimore Choral Arts Society in this performance from November 1985. On 88.1 WYPR, it's Choral Arts Classics. So let's listen now to a beautiful movement for women's voices, and then the final three movements from Bach's great Magnificat. We'll start with the mournful trio Sushepit Israel for three solo women's voices, and then we'll hear the chorus Sicut Locutus Est and move into the final two choruses, a regal and majestic Gloria Patri, concluding with the energetic setting of Et in Saecula Saeculorum, which picks up the musical material that Bach introduced in the very first movement of the Magnificat. So again, the texts mean this: He hath received Israel his servant, being mindful of his mercy, as he spoke to our fathers, to Abraham and to his seed forever. Again, as Ray mentioned, the implication or the discussion of Abraham, Bach goes back to the Renaissance and the old-fashioned style of music, and then glory be to the Father and to the Son and to the Holy Spirit, as it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen. So as it was in the beginning, Bach uses the music from the beginning of the Magnificat. Here's the last sections of Bach's Magnificat as we continue here on Choral Arts Classics. music of Johann Sebastian Bach, the final section of his beautiful Magnificat. This recording made at a live performance on November 3rd, 1985 in Goucher College's Krausauer Auditorium. Next month, the Choral Arts Full Chorus and Orchestra will perform Bach's Magnificat again for the first time since this recording was made on Saturday afternoon, October 25th at 4 o'clock at Goucher College in Krausauer Auditorium. Our program will also feature Mozart's famous Ave Verum Corpus and Beethoven's poignant elegiac song for chorus and orchestra. And in addition, we'll welcome back soprano Nola Richardson along with trumpeter Andrew Balio to perform Bach's beautiful cantata Jauchzet Gott in Allen-London. Again, that's Saturday afternoon, October 25th at 4 o'clock. Concert will last about an hour and a half, and you'll have plenty of time to grab some dinner and even make it to another concert if you're feeling particularly adventurous on that Saturday. For information about tickets to that event or to any of our concerts, visit us on the web at baltimorechoralarts.org or give us a call, 410-523-7070. And also, when you visit baltimorechoralarts.org, you can order Choral Arts CDs, including Christmas at America's First Cathedral and a recording with jazz legend Dave Brubeck. Again, for information about our performance of the Bach Magnificat or for information about any of our other concerts, please come to baltimorechoralarts.org or give us a call at 410-523-7070. You can hear Choral Arts Classics on the radio or on demand. Go to WIPR.org and catch up on the shows you might have missed or shows you'd like to hear again. The producer of Choral Arts Classics is Aaron Henkin. Don't forget to tune in to The Signal Friday nights at 7 and again on Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock, produced by Aaron Henkin and Lisa Morgan along with Andy Beanstock. And please join me, Sheila Cast, and Nathan Sterner for Maryland Morning tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, right after Morning Edition. I'm Tom Hall for WIPR and the Baltimore Choral Arts Society. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll see you next month on Choral Arts Classics.